Many people wonder how AA can function under such a seeming anarchy. Other societies have to have law and force and sanction and punishment administered by authorized people. Happily for us, we found we need no human authority whatever. We have two authorities which are far more effective. One is benign, the other malign. There is God, our Father, who very simply says, "I am waiting for you to do my will." The other authority is named John Barleycorn, and he says, "You had better do God's will or I will kill you." And sometimes he does kill. So when all the chips are down, we conform to God's will or perish. At this level, the death sentence hangs over the AA member, his group, and AA as a whole. Therefore, we have the full benefits of the murderous political dictatorships of today, but none of their liabilities. So there is authority enough, love enough, and punishment enough, all without any human being clutching the handles of power. Such is AA's backstop against dissolution, and its final guarantee of survival under any conditions. For us, it is do or die. But this is not the whole story. As our individual and group development progresses, we begin to obey the AA traditions for other reasons. We begin to obey them because we think they are right for us. We obey these principles because we think they are good principles, even though we still resist somewhat. Then comes the final level of obedience, the best of all. We obey AA steps and traditions because we really want them for ourselves. It is no longer a question of good or evil. We conform because we genuinely want to conform. Such is our process of growth in unity and in function. Such is the evidence of God's grace and love among us. Much of our discussion so far leads straight to Tradition 5, which states, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. We think we should do one thing well rather than many things to which we are not called. That is the central idea of this tradition. Our society gathers in unity around this concept. The very life of our fellowship requires its preservation. Shoemaker, stick to thy last, is no dull cliché for Alcoholics Anonymous. Together we have found a substantial remedy for a terrible malady. Of course, we might interest ourselves in fields of education, research, neurosis, and the like. But as a society, should we? Our experience says that we definitely should not. We can and we do help as individuals in those fields. That is good. But as a fellowship, we know that we must not be diverted. It is our experience as alcoholics that makes us of unique value on our sector of the total alcoholic front. We can approach sufferers as no one else can. Therefore, the strongest kind of moral and ethical compulsion is upon us to do this and nothing more. If we had discovered a widely applicable cancer cure, we would be begged to attend to that and that only. We would not try to look after all tumors and branch out into tuberculosis and tapeworms besides. In such a case, we would certainly stick to cancer. Though AA is obligated to both medicine and religion, we cannot become experts in either. We know that theology is for clergymen, and that the practice of medicine and psychiatry is for doctors. Certain that we can do together what we cannot do separately, we shall always cooperate, but never compete. We shall direct our energies where they count most. Most emphatically, then, AA has but one single purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. That is our basic objective, our real reason for existence. A logical outgrowth of Tradition 5, Tradition 6 reads, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. In the old days, our foundation, now the General Service Board, was originally chartered to do everything but lobby for prohibition. We were chartered for education. We were chartered for research. We could do almost anything. And we used to think we wanted a lot of money to do a lot of things. Out in the groups, the same ideas often prevailed. At that time, hospitals did not want us, so we thought we would build and operate our own. People needed to be told what alcoholism was, so we thought we would educate the public, perhaps rewrite school and medical textbooks. We thought we would revise the laws of the land and have it declared that alcoholics are sick people. We would carry AA into the dark regions of dope addiction and criminality. We would form groups for depressive and paranoid folks. And the deeper the neurosis, the better we would like it. If alcoholism could be licked, so could any problem. AA's uncompromising honesty might soon clean up politics. In the factories, it could cause laborers and capitalists to love each other. Having learned to live so happily, we would show everybody else how. We thought our society of Alcoholics Anonymous might prove to be the spearhead of a new spiritual advance. Our principles might transform the world. Yes, we did dream those dreams. How natural that was, since most alcoholics are bankrupt idealists. Nearly every one of us had wished to do great good, perform great deeds that embodied great ideals. We were perfectionists who, failing to attain perfection, had gone to the other extreme and settled for the bottle and the blackout. Providence, through AA, had brought us within reach of our highest expectations. So why shouldn't we share our way of life with everyone? Well, we tried AA hospitals, and they all bogged down because you cannot put an AA group into business. Too many busybody cooks always spoil the broth. AA groups had their fling at education, and when they began publicly to whoop up the merits of this or that brand of education, people became confused. Did AA fix alcoholics, or was it an educational project? Was AA spiritual, or was it medical? Was it a reform movement? In consternation, we saw ourselves getting married to all kinds of enterprises, some good and some not so good. When we saw alcoholics committed willy-nilly to prisons and asylums, we began to say there ought to be a law. In full public view, some AAs commenced to thump tables in legislative committee rooms and to agitate for legal reform. That made good newspaper copy, but little else. We saw that we would soon be mired in politics. We found it imperative, even inside AA, to remove the AA name from clubs and 12-step houses. These strenuous adventures implanted the deep-rooted conviction that in no circumstances could we endorse any related enterprise, no matter how good. We of Alcoholics Anonymous could not be all things to all men, and we should not try to be. The moment we lent the AA name to any outside enterprise, we got into trouble, sometimes very serious trouble. At one time, we nearly got embroiled in the wet-dry controversy. A liquor trade association wanted to hire an AA member as an educator. Its members wanted to teach that too much grog is bad for everybody and that alcoholics cannot drink at all. So far, so good. But it further appeared that in all their publicity, they wished to stress the fact that their educator, Mr. X, was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was something else again. The public would at once think that Alcoholics Anonymous had gone into the field of education via the liquor industry. If that happened, the Drys would instantly hire another AA member for educational purposes. This would land us, of course, smack in the middle of endless controversy. We simply could not take sides in this fight and do business with sick alcoholics, too. The would-be educator showed up at the New York office asking for advice. Of course, we told him that we thought factual education to be a very good thing, and that as a public relations expert and as a citizen, he certainly had a perfect right to take the job. But did he think that he should advertise his AA membership at the same time? Our member got the point. He said, Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. It comes first. I certainly won't be the guy to land AA in big-time trouble, and this might really do it. Our friend had summed up the whole endorsement problem. We saw, as never before, that we could not lend the AA name to any cause other than our own. Long afterward, we saw something else. We saw that the more AA minded its own business, the greater its general influence would become. Medicine and religion and psychiatry began to borrow some of our ideas and experience. So did research, rehabilitation, and education. All sorts of therapeutic groups began to spring up. They dealt with gambling, divorce, delinquency, dope addiction, mental illness, and the like. They, too, borrowed from AA, but they made their own adaptations. They worked their own fields, and we did not have to endorse them or tell them how to live. Our influence has not been confined just to these fields. It is beginning now to be general. It crops out in political and business life. People who know alcoholics and their families are deeply affected. The very developments that we once wanted to force have begun to take place of themselves. Today we understand and accept this paradox. The more AA sticks to its primary purpose, the greater will be its helpful influence everywhere. Let us now talk about money and AA's attitude toward it. Wealth had ruined many men and nations. So, would it ruin us? Especially in America, money was a symbol of prestige and power and comfort. Money can do a lot of good, yet there is practically no evil which it cannot arouse. Would AA's brand of spirituality mix with any money at all? Or, on the other hand, should we have a lot of money, the better to do good works? This was the age-old dilemma and the temptation that faced us. The conservatives said, Why tempt ourselves with money? We don't need it. We can meet in homes, and no group will have to have a treasury. Why do we need books and offices and world services? One alcoholic carries the message to another. Let's keep it that simple and stay out of money trouble. The radicals thought otherwise. Not only do we need essential services, we need plenty more. We need hospitals, paid therapists, traveling lecturers, rehabilitation centers, and heaven knows what else. It is going to take millions. And where will we get all this money? Well, we will get it from the public, just as most other good works do. After a while, we awoke to the pleasant fact that AA, as such, was not going to require much money after all. When we got rid of our grandiose ideas about hospitals, research, rehabilitation, and education, not much of a bill was left to pay. Other enterprises needed large sums, but we did not. We could be spared that headache. A big factor in our thinking at the time was the philosophy of St. Francis of Assisi. His also began as a lay movement, one man carrying the good news to the next. In his day, it was common enough for individuals to pledge themselves to poverty. But it was unusual, if not unique, for a whole organization or fellowship to do the same thing. For the purpose of his society, Francis thought corporate poverty to be fundamental. The less money and property they had to quarrel about, the less would be the diversion from their primary purpose. And just like AA today, his outfit did not need much money to accomplish its mission. Why be tempted and diverted when there was no need for it? Therefore, AA adopted the wisdom of Francis as its own. Not only would we have the least possible service organization, we would use the least possible money. For us, this does not mean no money at all, but it does mean the least possible money to do the job well. It is in this sense that AA has declared for the principle of corporate poverty. It is a chief safeguard of our future. Despite our early tradition of keeping AA poor for its own safety, we were still to have temptations. There were three of them. The first came when we met with Mr. John D. Rockefeller, Jr. and his friends in the fall of 1937. At that time, the possibility of unlimited financial backing pretty much dimmed our sharing of the vision of St. Francis. Dr. Bob and I, and indeed most of us, were awfully broke. Ideas of comfortable and well-paid jobs, chains of AA hospitals, and tons of free literature for suffering alkies seized our imagination. But Mr. Rockefeller had other ideas. He said, "I think money will spoil this." He acted accordingly, and AA stayed poor. St. Francis had given us the idea, but John D. wisely forced us to live up to it. This was the oddly assorted pair who were really responsible for AA's tradition on money. Thank God for them both. The second temptation veered to the other extreme. We got so scared of money that we went tightwad, half refusing to support AA's simple but essential area and overall services, without which we would fail to function and grow. Even now, we haven't quite surmounted this one. We still drag our heels when the hat is passed to support local intergroup offices and general headquarters. And this holding back is not for lack of folding money either. The collective income of AA's membership, the sum of our wages, salaries, and other emoluments, will presently reach a total of $1 billion yearly. When sober and working, few alcoholics have any money trouble. Our earning power as individuals may actually be double the average. The material payoff, as well as the spiritual payoff, of AA's way of life is downright incredible. Nevertheless, we still balk a bit when it comes to paying AA's very reasonable service bills. Sometimes I think this may be all to the good. There is not the slightest danger that AA is ever going to get too rich from the voluntary contributions of its own members. There is a funny but revealing story about this, and the joke is on me. It was in 1941, just after the Saturday Evening Post story broke. The income from the AA book would not pay for answering the thousands of inquiries, and we had set up $1 a year per member as the measuring stick for voluntary contributions that might meet the bill. It was the first time AA headquarters had asked groups for any help. At the time, Lois and I were receiving $30 a week as a result of Mr. Rockefeller's dinner. We were living in a little room in the 24th Street Club. Our household furniture was still in storage, and we were mighty hard up. One morning, a bleary-eyed friend, just off a bender, stuck his head into the little VC Street office. I was pacing up and down, cussing out the drunks for being so slow in sending in their buck apiece. I was in a really mean mood, so I gave my bleary-eyed friend a big gripe on how stingy drunks were. Naturally, he agreed. Just to make myself generous, I pulled out a $5 bill and handed it to him. It was money that Lois needed for the groceries, and I knew very well that he would go out and drink it up. But this grandiose act made me feel good. I, poor I, could give $5 when those guys out there couldn't even send in $1. Distinctly satisfied with myself, I went to the meeting that night in the club. The club was behind with its rent. In those days, you could not mix the material with the spiritual at all. Money was a subject you could hardly mention. But the landlord was not getting his rent, so it had to be mentioned. At intermission, my old friend Tom B., who led the meeting that night, timidly said, "Now, folks, can't you go a little heavy on the hat tonight? We're kind of behind with the rent." Such was his apologetic announcement. I was sitting on the stairs with some new convert. Nevertheless, I heard him, and I knew the club was behind. Finally, the hat came up the stairs, where we were, and I reached in my pocket and got a coin. When I fished it out, it was $0.50. Scarcely thinking, I dropped that $0.50 back into my pocket and produced a dime that clinked thinly in the hat. A minute later, I woke up. I, who had boasted of my generosity that morning, was treating my own club worse than the alcoholics who had forgotten to send the foundation their dollars. I realized that my $5 gift to the backslider was an ego-feeding act, bad for him and bad for me. There was a place in AA where spirituality and money would mix, and that was in the hat. I never since have criticized anybody for failing to send a dollar or so to headquarters. Our third money temptation was the greatest peril of all three. One night, the trustees of our foundation were having their quarterly meeting. The agenda included a crucial question. A certain lady had died, and when her will was read, it was discovered that she had left to Alcoholics Anonymous, in trust with the foundation, a sum of $10,000. The question was, should AA take the gift? What a debate we had on that one. The foundation was really hard up just then. The groups were not sending in enough money for the support of the office. We had been tossing in all the book income, and even that had not been enough. The reserve fund was melting like snow in springtime. We badly needed that $10,000. Maybe, some said, the groups will never fully support the office. We can't let it shut down. It is far too vital. Yes, let's take the money. Let's take all such donations in the future. We're going to need them. Then came the opposition. They pointed out that the foundation board already knew of a total of $500,000 set aside for AA in the wills of people still alive. Heaven only knew how much we had not heard about. If outside donations were not declined, not absolutely cut off, the foundation would one day become rich. Moreover, at the slightest intimation to the general public from our trustees that we needed money, we could become immensely rich. Compared to this prospect, the $10,000 under consideration was not much. But like the alcoholic's first drink, it would, if taken, inevitably set up a disastrous chain reaction. Where would that land us? Whoever pays the piper is apt to call the tune. And if the AA Foundation obtained money from outside sources, its trustees might be tempted to run things without reference to the wishes of AA as a whole. Every alcoholic, feeling relieved of responsibility, would shrug and say, "Oh, the foundation is wealthy. Why should I bother?" The pressure of that fat treasury would surely tempt the board to invent all kinds of schemes to do good with such funds and so divert AA from its primary purpose. The moment that happened, our fellowship's confidence would be shaken. The board might be isolated and might fall under heavy attack and criticism from both AA and the public. These were the possibilities, pro and con. Then our trustees wrote a bright page of AA history. They declared for the principle that AA must always stay poor. Reasonable running expenses plus a prudent reserve would henceforth be the foundation's financial policy. Regardless of current needs, the trustees officially declined that $10,000 and adopted a formal, airtight resolution that all such future gifts would be similarly declined. At that moment, the principle of corporate poverty was firmly and finally embedded in AA tradition. When the newspapers got hold of these facts, there was a profound reaction. To people familiar with endless drives for charitable funds, AA presented a strange and refreshing spectacle. Approving editorials here and abroad generated a great new wave of confidence in the integrity of Alcoholics Anonymous. They pointed out that the irresponsible had become responsible, and that by making financial independence part of its tradition, Alcoholics Anonymous had revived an ideal that this era had almost forgotten. This is why AA's Tradition 7 now reads, "Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions." Tradition 8 says that Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Alcoholics Anonymous will never have a professional therapeutic class. We have gained some understanding of the ancient words, "Freely you have received, freely give." For our purpose, we have discovered that at the point of professionalism, money and spirituality do not mix. We do not decry professionalism in other fields, but we accept the sober fact that it does not work for us. Every time we have tried to professionalize our 12th step, the result has been exactly the same. Our single purpose has been defeated. You remember how I was told by AA's group conscience that I could not go to work for Charlie Towns as a professional therapist, and that was right. Early in the game, we discover that under no conditions should an AA be paid for taking or carrying this message to somebody else, person to person and face to face. That was out. If professionalism ever invaded us at that level, we were doomed. But the issue of professionalism had other aspects. For years, we were trying to figure out what in AA was professionalism and what was not. This problem arose out of the need for paid workers in our service centers, the need for people who would do the jobs that volunteers could not or would not do. Were service workers professionals or were they not? That was the issue. The first situation of this kind that I can remember came up in the old clubhouse on 24th Street in New York. Volunteers had painted the place and shined it up and were answering the telephone, and that was fine. When they went home, they would hand out numerous keys for the benefit of the night owls. But some of the owls had a habit of getting stewed and lying around the place in all conditions and at all hours. That was not good. The volunteers also got very tired of sweeping out the place, so it stayed dirty most of the time. Plainly enough, we needed a caretaker. Well, we approached old Tom, a fireman we had recently sprung out of Rockland Asylum. We were shrewd. We already knew that Tom had a pension as a fireman, so we said to him, "How would you like to come over, Tom, and live at the club? Nice room for you there." Tom said, "What's the angle?" "Well, Tom, we'll give you a nice room, and you can kind of look after the place." Tom said, "7 days a week?" "Yeah. What am I supposed to do?" "Well, Tom, you ought to make the coffee and, you know, lead the drunks out if they're too bad and sweep the place up." "Do that 7 days a week?" said Tom. "What you guys want is a janitor." "All right," we said. "Sure, we want a janitor." "Well," said Tom, "ain't you going to pay me nothing?" "Oh, no," we said. "That would make you a professional. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. We must not mix money with spirituality." "Okay," said Tom. "No money, no work. I'm doing my 12-step work free. But if you're going to have me here as a janitor, you're going to pay me, see?" Lots of us were working at that time and earning money, but believe it or not, we actually haggled with that old man to get him down to the last cent we could for doing that grubby job. But old Tom was right. In order for AA to function, we had to hire some help. In all the length and breadth of AA, among the whole 200,000 or more of us, we have today only 200 or 300 hired help all around. That includes cooks frying hamburgers in clubs, janitors sweeping out the places, and women answering telephones in our central offices. It also includes me. I once wrote some literature for you, so I am paid a royalty for being a writer. That is where the line finally fell. For face-to-face treatment of a drunk, no money ever. But AA does have to hire people so that it can function where there are legitimate jobs to be done. Even after AA's Tradition 8 was thus established in principle, it took still more years to work out the applications. There were all sorts of borderline cases, always in hot debate. For example, no AAs have been more buffeted by such emotional gusts than those bold enough to accept employment with outside agencies dealing with the alcohol problem. A university wanted an AA member to educate the public on alcoholism. A corporation wanted a personnel man familiar with the subject. A state drunk farm wanted a manager who could really handle inebriates. A city wanted an experienced social worker who understood what alcohol could do to a family. A state alcohol commission wanted a paid researcher. These are only a few of the jobs which AA members as individuals are filling today. Now and then, AA members have bought farms or rest homes where badly beat up topers could find needed care. The question was, are such activities to be branded as professionalism under AA tradition? Our years of experience tell us that the answer is no. Members who select such full-time careers do not professionalize AA's 12-step. The road to this conclusion was long and rocky. At first, we could not see the real issue involved. In former days, the moment an AA hired out to such enterprises, he was immediately tempted to use the name Alcoholics Anonymous for publicity or money-raising purposes. Drunk farms, educational ventures, state legislatures, and commissions advertise the fact that AA members serve them. Unthinkingly, AAs who were so employed recklessly broke their anonymity to thump the tub for their pet enterprises. For this reason, some very good causes and everything connected with them suffered unjust criticism from AA groups. There were cries of professionalism. That guy is making money out of AA. Yet not a single one of them had been hired to do AA's 12-step work. The violation in these instances was not professionalism at all. It was breaking anonymity. AA's sole purpose was being compromised, and the name of Alcoholics Anonymous was being misused. It is significant now that almost no AA in our fellowship breaks anonymity at the general public level. And so nearly all of these fears have subsided. We see that we have no right or need to discourage AAs who wish to work as individuals in these wider fields. It would be actually antisocial were we to discourage them. We cannot declare AA such a close corporation that we keep our knowledge and experience top secret. If an AA member, acting as a citizen, can become a better researcher, educator, or personnel officer, why not? Everybody gains, and we have lost nothing. True, some of the projects to which AAs have attached themselves have been ill-conceived, but that makes not the slightest difference in the principle involved. This is the exciting chain of events that finally cast up AA's tradition of non-professionalism. Our 12th step, carrying the message, is never to be paid for, but those who labor in service for us are worthy of their hire. Tradition 9 states, AA, as such, ought never to be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. This one still puzzles a lot of people. How can you have a society that is unorganized and at the same time, organize services? Yet, AA does it. When Tradition 9 was first written, it said, Alcoholics Anonymous needs the least possible organization. In the years since then, we have changed our minds about that. Today, we are able to say with assurance that Alcoholics Anonymous, AA as a whole, should never be organized at all. Then, in seeming contradiction, we proceed to create special boards and committees which in themselves are organized. How can we have an unorganized movement which can and does create a service organization for itself? Scanning this puzzler, people say, what do they mean, no organization? What we really mean, of course, is that AA can never have an organized direction or government. To amplify this, did anyone ever hear of a nation, a church, a political party, even a benevolent association that had no membership rules? Did anyone ever hear of a society that could not somehow discipline its members and enforce obedience to necessary rules and regulations? Does not nearly every society on earth give authority to some of its members to impose obedience upon the rest and to punish or expel offenders? Therefore, every nation, in fact, every form of society, has to be a government administered by human beings. Power to direct and govern is the essence of organization everywhere. To this rule, Alcoholics Anonymous is a complete exception. It does not at any point conform to the pattern of a government. Neither its General Service Conference, its General Service Board, nor the humblest group committee can issue a single directive to an AA member and make it stick, let alone hand out any punishment. We have tried it lots of times, but failure is always the result. Groups have tried to expel members, but the banished have come back to sit in the meeting place, saying, "This is life for us. You can't keep us out." Committees have instructed many an AA to stop working on a chronic backslider, only to be told, "How I do my 12-step work is my business. Who are you to judge?" An AA may take advice or suggestions from more experienced members, but he surely will not take orders. Who is less popular than the old-time AA, full of wisdom, who moves to another area and tries to tell the group there how to run its business? He and all like him who view with alarm for the good of AA meet with stubborn resistance or, worse still, laughter. In fact, AA is so unorganized that someone once suggested we put up a sign in each AA club saying, "Anything goes here, folks, except you mustn't smoke opium in the elevators." One would think that AA's headquarters and General Service Conference would be exceptions. Surely the people there would have to have some authority. But long ago, trustees and staff members alike found that they could do no more than make suggestions, and very mild ones at that. They even had to coin a couple of sentences which still go into half the letters they write. Of course, you are at perfect liberty to handle this matter any way you please. But the majority experience in AA does seem to suggest. Now, that attitude is far removed from central government, isn't it? We recognize that we cannot dictate to fellow members individually or collectively. At this juncture, we can hear a churchman exclaim, "They are making disobedience a virtue." He is joined by the psychiatrist who says, "Defiant brats. They won't grow up and conform to social usage." The man in the street says, "I don't understand it. They must be nuts." But all these observers have overlooked one very unusual condition in Alcoholics Anonymous. Unless each AA member follows to the best of his ability our suggested 12 steps of recovery, he almost certainly signs his own death warrant. Drunkenness and disintegration are not penalties inflicted by people in authority. They are results of personal disobedience to spiritual principles. We must obey certain principles, or we die. The same stern threat applies to the group itself. Unless there is approximate conformity to AA's 12 traditions, the group, too, can deteriorate and die. So we of AA do obey spiritual principles, first, because we must, and ultimately, because we love the kind of life such obedience brings. Great suffering and great love are AA's disciplinarians. We have no others. Therefore, it is now clear that we ought never to name boards to govern us. It is equally clear, however, that we shall always need to authorize workers to serve us. Here we discriminate between the spirit of vested authority and the spirit of service, concepts which are sometimes poles apart. It is in this spirit of service that we elect the AA group's informal rotating committees, the intergroup associations of the area, and the General Service Conference for AA as a whole. Even our trustees, once an independent body, are today directly accountable to our fellowship. They are the caretakers and expediters of our world services. Just as the aim of each AA member is personal sobriety, so the aim of our services is to bring sobriety within reach of all who want it. If nobody did the group's chores, if the area's telephone rang unanswered, if we did not reply to our mail, then AA, as we know it, would stop. Our communication lines with those who need our help would be broken. While AA has to function, it must at the same time avoid wealth, prestige, and power, three great dangers which necessarily tempt nearly all human societies. Though Tradition 9 at first sight seems to deal with purely practical matters, it embodies a deep spirituality in its actual operation. AA is a society without organization, animated only by the spirit of service, a true fellowship. How this unique situation developed is seen in the following example. Joe Doe goes to Middletown, USA. He is an AA member in good standing from another city. In Middletown, there is no AA group. Joe feels lonesome and a little frightened. He also wants to carry the message. So maybe he puts an ad in the paper saying that AA has come to town. Maybe he goes to the preachers and the doctors and bartenders and scrapes himself up a few prospects. Pretty soon, there is a little group. At first, Joe is the dictator, and these first members are his hierarchy, literally. They have all the authority there is. This local founder and his friends teach AA principles and make all the group's arrangements. The group goes on growing broader and broader at the base. For a while, they accept all that Joe and his friends say. They take directions, quite rightly, because at this stage there is no other way. But by and by, something happens. Maybe Joe and his friends have a falling out. Or maybe some power driver down in the base of the triangle begins to murmur, "How long are these old-timers going to keep running this thing?" Meanwhile, the founder and his friends bask a little in glory. They say to one another, "Perhaps it would be a good idea if we continue to keep a firm hand on AA in this town. After all, we are experienced. Besides, look at all the good we have done those drunks. They should be grateful." True, founders and their friends are sometimes wiser and more humble than this, but often at this stage, they are not. Growing pains now beset the group. Panhandlers panhandle. Lonely hearts pine. Problems descend. Murmurs are again heard in the body politic, which swell into a loud cry. "Do these old-timers think they can run this thing forever? Let's have an election." The founder and his friends are hurt and depressed. They rush from crisis to crisis and from member to member pleading. But it is no use. The revolution is on. The group is about to take over. If the founder and his friends serve well, they may, to their surprise, be reinstated for a time. If, however, they have heavily resisted the rising tide of democracy, they may be summarily beached. In either case, the group now has a so-called rotating committee, very sharply limited in its authority. In no sense whatever can its members govern or direct the group. Theirs is sometimes a thankless privilege of doing the group's chores. This committee can only make the necessary service arrangements by which the group can function. It can give no spiritual advice, judge no one's conduct, issue no orders. Any committee member may be promptly eliminated at the next election if he tries to throw his weight around. The members fully realize that they are actually servants, not senators. These are universal AA experiences. Thus, throughout our fellowship, does the group conscience decree the terms upon which its leaders shall serve.